For the Lore of the Land, this is Jack Loeffler. Today on Watersheds as Commons, we'll look into the Great Plains of eastern New Mexico and the watersheds of the Canadian River and the Rio Pecos. And we'll visit the Gila country in southwestern New Mexico. Just southeast of Santa Fe is a point where three distinct geophysical divisions of the continent converge: the Great Plains, the Rocky Mountains, and the Intermountain West. Dr. Dave Hafner is a biogeographer who spent much of his career as director of science at the New Mexico Natural History Museum in Albuquerque. Here, he tells us of the extraordinary geographical diversity to be found in New Mexico.
You know, the reason scientists come to New Mexico is that incredible biodiversity. And the three reasons we're so diverse: one is just location. If you took a little cookie cutter, the shape of New Mexico, and kind of moved it around in the United States and tried to encompass more ecosystems, you'd be hard-pressed to do so. You'd wind up right where we are, where the Rockies join the Great Plains, join the Southern Deserts, join the Basin and Range coming over. And then you look at a map of the United States, topography-wise, and pretty much flat central and eastern, and very jumbled western. We have half of our state is the jumbled topography. The other half is this flat area with little isolated peaks throughout. The desert islands that attract so many of us so much. And then a third thing, when you add to that, to the topography and location, time element. With particularly the quaternary glacial oscillations, where we had these waves of cool, wet versus warm, dry climate washing across the state back and forth and back and forth, allowing mountain forms to move down and get over to the next island, only to be isolated there, sort of like a can washed up on a seashore, little bits and pieces of flotsam. And that happened not just once, but repeatedly. It's just a wonderful mixture we have here. It's the best natural laboratory one can imagine. Even if you go south, you get higher diversity south, because you pick up more and more species as you get towards the equator. But in terms of large-scale diversity, where are you going to find the mountains and deserts and riparian areas cutting through it? Added to all those four zones, you have the second largest rift on the face of the earth cutting right through the middle of the state. Pretty awesome.
During the 1930s, a major drought coupled with high winds that scoured tens of thousands of acres of the Great Plains, whose topsoil had been deeply disturbed by farming, resulted in the Dust Bowl that left thousands of people homeless and penniless. John Steinbeck's great American novel, The Grapes of Wrath, won him the Pulitzer Prize and provided a poignant view into the hardships of those affected by the Dust Bowl days. Wanda Hughes lived her long life near Clayton, New Mexico. She grew up on a ranch in the Canadian River watershed and well remembered that first day when the topsoils of Oklahoma and Texas clouded New Mexico's skies.
We had more moisture in those years, evidently. Everybody did some farming and had cattle and livestock. Most people milked cows, we milked cows and sold cream. I was 2 years old and my brother was 4 years old when my dad was killed by lightning, instantly. And I was probably about 16, because I remember the real bad Dust Bowl that day. My husband and I had gone to the ranch and we were on our way back. We were about halfway back to town when that big cloud started rolling in. It just rolled in, you could see it real slow, and by the time it got to where we were, about halfway to town, we stopped at a farmhouse. Just barely got in the house when it just enveloped the whole country. You couldn't even see, it was just dark. That was the worst day. But for several years, we had lots of wind and dirt, lots of dust. So it was tough during the Dust Bowl days. We had a good well, we had lots of water, and we always had a good garden, and we raised our own vegetables, and we had cattle, and we had pigs, and we always had plenty of food. We had always had chickens and pork and beef, and in the wintertime we'd have a quarter of beef hanging in the top of the windmill tower, and we could have fresh steak any time we wanted it. you know, we had plenty to eat. Well, it was during the drought, actually. And that was in the 30s when so many people started moving out. Because a lot of people moved out of our country, out there. There used to be somebody on every half section, almost. And during the drought, when it got so dry and everybody, you couldn't raise a crop. When they used to try to plant anything because you couldn't, we didn't have any rain. So people started leaving the country. I don't know how we managed to stay, but we did. Do you know the water table has never lowered? I have three wells on my place, and the water's still just as strong as it ever was. Now, out south here, out southwest of Clayton, there's a lot of irrigation, and it must be on a different level, different water table, because they've had some of their wells have gone dry.
Stacy Galassini is an archaeologist employed by the Cibola National Forest in Albuquerque. She speaks of the congressional acts that were passed to help both restore an overgrazed, overblown landscape and a destitute human population during the Great Depression of the 1930s.
Of course, through all the homesteading and overgrazing, and then the drought, which created the Dust Bowl, people were very poor, very destitute, and just picked up and left, or the bank foreclosed on them and they left. And so what was left were these little sections of land, 160 acres, 320 acres, these original homestead plots that never panned out and were never going to pan out because it wasn't enough to live on. First, something called the Taylor Grazing Act happened in 1934, and these were all the acts, the WPA, the CCC, all the Depression-era Roosevelt administration acts to rehabilitate the land. And Taylor Grazing Act started the process for grazing legislation, stop overgrazing, and then the Bankhead Jones Tenant Farm Act was the act that allowed the government to take back the land from abandoned, from the bank, basically, bought them from the bank.
The headwaters of the Canadian River are in southeastern Colorado. The river courses northwest to southeast through northeastern New Mexico, then passing through the Texas Panhandle and Oklahoma before joining the Arkansas River that empties into the Mississippi River. Brian Miller is a conservation biologist who works at the Wind River Ranch in northeastern New Mexico. Here, he addresses a bigger picture approach to restoration of grasslands in the Canadian River watershed and the role of bison as members of their biotic community.
If you're looking at ecological restoration, bison were the native species. They evolved in this system. And if you want to restore something, then it makes more sense to use the native species than an exotic species who may partially fulfill the niche but not totally fill the niche. Well, not much has been known about the role of bison in grassland health because they were eliminated so long ago and perhaps so shamefully. So what we're seeing is that the pinyon juniper trees that have been advancing onto the grasslands historically were found up on the shallow soils of the rocky slopes, and now they're advancing down to the deeper soils of the grassland, and they cannot compete the grass when they do that because juniper in particular is one of the most drought-resistant plants known. The system of transporting water through the plant cavitation is one of the strongest of any plant. Juniper have a network of roots that extend 3 to 4 times the height of the tree in a circle around the tree. That network of roots is just about 6 inches below the soil, so they can outcompete the grass when it rains, and they have a taproot that can go down more than 150 feet. So what happens is if juniper advance onto the grassland, they change the density and the diversity of the grass around the tree. The grass that is tougher in terms of dry conditions are the grass species that will survive. And if there are enough trees close enough together, it can denude the soil. And if that's on a slope, the lack of vegetation increases the speed which water rolls down that slope, eventually cutting a gully and forming an arroyo. So most people thought that pinyon and juniper were kept off of the grassland by fire, and that changing fire regimes and perhaps overgrazing as well, reducing the competition, allowed pinyon juniper to advance out on the grasslands. But what we're seeing is that bison break pinyon and juniper and horn up yucca, another plant that should be on the shallow soils of the slopes. So it appears that they may have played a role as well, perhaps along with fire, in keeping the pinon juniper relegated to the slopes and allowing grasses to dominate on the deeper, richer soils. The saying in Kenya is that elephants make grass and cows make trees, and the bison may be playing a role similar to African elephants in keeping grasslands in grass by the action of breaking the trees.
Again, Stacy Galassini.
When the Jicarilla came last year and did a presentation on the buffalo that they would like to put back on the grasslands, their herd at Watrous, they did a very nice presentation about why the buffalo is important to them, even more today than it maybe was then. Because when it supports your whole culture and lifestyle, it's your lifeblood, and they used almost every part of the buffalo for one thing or another, down to the sinew, you know, down to the hooves, down to the everything. And so when something's that important to you, it's not a like an Anglo-European culture. It's not something you conquer and manhandle and eventually rub off the earth. It's not a adversarial relationship. It's a symbiotic one. So even as they hunt them and kill them and eat them, it's the life cycle that's prayed about and talked about and sung about between the buffalo and man.
Again, Brian Miller.
Probably the biggest elimination of the grassland systems came about, you know, over 100 years ago with the railroads, with the towns, and it was basically a bushmeat trade, feeding the forts, feeding the railroad workers. And so they eliminated many of the ungulates, not just the predators. And when they brought cows in, of course, then they wanted to eliminate the predators that could eat cows. Wolves were common on the grasslands. Grizzly bears were on the grasslands. So they probably played a role, perhaps in regulating numbers, certainly in changing behavior. When you remove a predator from a system, then the prey species typically changes its behavior. You know, everything is as lazy as it can be to get by. If all of a sudden you eliminate a predator and you don't have to be in as big a groups, you don't have to restrict your hunting to the hours when the predator is out or not out, you can expand your niche. And what happens when these prey species, which perhaps are kept within a niche by the ecological boundaries of the presence of the predator, when you remove that predator, then you remove the fences, the ecological boundaries, and you allow these animals to spread their niche out, and the niches start to overlap, and the superior competitor will outcompete the others.
Roberta Ball works for the Reservoir Control Branch of the United States Army Corps of Engineers in Albuquerque. Here she addresses the Canadian River Compact.
Based on the Interstate Compact for the Canadian River, the states involved are New Mexico, Texas, and Oklahoma. Based on the compact, the state of New Mexico has all rights to use any water originating above Conchos. Conchos itself isn't that subject to the compact. Now, all the reservoirs below Conchos in New Mexico, the compact limits the state of New Mexico to a total storage capacity of about 200,000 acre feet, all total. Ute being the largest of those projects, and there's several smaller projects. There's dozens of little tiny off-stream diversions and dams in the Canadian Basin. And so the sum of all those can't exceed 200,000 acre feet.
Jim Wilcox has had a career in the potash industry in Carlsbad, New Mexico, and knows a great deal about the Pecos River.
Pecos River heads up in the Pecos Wilderness at Pecos, New Mexico, above Pecos, New Mexico. And it's a pretty viable river up in that part of the world. There's a lot of snow in the wintertime and a lot of rains in that area normally. And that's what creates the major flow in the Pecos River up in that area. When you get past Fort Sumner down in this area, it's very arid. There's not much water here. But we do catch some water from the Sacramento Mountains. Most of it goes underground in the Sacramento Mountains, and it comes up in the way of springs in the Pecos River. In this area, we have two aquifers. One is the Artesian Aquifer, which is part of the Pecos River system. And it's Artesia, the area of Artesia north of Brantley Dam, actually is where it starts. And then you have Artesia and Roswell in that area. And then beyond Brantley, this area down here, it's the Capitan Reef Aquifer. You get some flow from the Guadalupe Mountains here locally, some springs up there, and all of this system feeds the Pecos River.
Author M. Hall is an attorney who worked both in the New Mexico State Engineer's Office and at the University of New Mexico in Albuquerque. Here he speaks of the fundamental premise that underlies water law in New Mexico and beyond.
I used to work for the state engineer. I knew and loved those people, and I still do. For them, these compacts are simply a fact of life, an immutable geological fact of life. You know, even though they're entirely outdated and don't reflect the modern understandings of either the science or the nature of the social world. But that's where you start. That's where they start, and don't question that. With respect to that, all of these legal regimes that control the use of this, from water to cattle grazing to mining, are all focused on the private rights to use natural resources for the maximization of economic exploitation. And I don't mean that in any bad sense. That's just how all of these legal regimes work. You know, so by and large, I mean, except for the Clean Water Act, you know, and these the Endangered Species Act and a few of those, you know, but the rest of them drive resources through a private property regime.
Again, Jim Wilcox.
Actually, you know, there's a lot of people say a lot of bad things about the compact between Texas and New Mexico on the Pecos River. Actually, from my point of view, I think from our perspective, it's probably a pretty good compact for New Mexico. Texas, under the terms of the compact, what they receive is about 10% of the proceeds of the river. They get half of the flood water, flood inflow that goes into the Pecos River.
And that comes from the snowmelt or the rainfall?
Mainly rainfall. Mm-hmm. When you look at the proceeds of the river, everything that's produced by the river, the water that's pumped out of the ground that would be in the river otherwise, Texas probably gets about 10% of the proceeds of that river. No, I think there needs to be some sort of private entity, not the government, start educating people about water and what we're faced with in reality. You know, we're to the point now, whatever the government tells us, we don't believe. It needs to be a group that has the credentials and the trust where people will believe what they're told. And that's not the federal government, and it's not the state government. You know, where everybody's getting a bad taste about the government right now, and rightfully so, probably. But there needs to be an education about water. There's a fallacy in water conservation. Like in our area, you tell people not to use water more than they have to, you know, cut back on water in your lawns, cut back on everything as a way of water. In this aquifer, when the aquifer reaches a certain point, it starts flowing into the river, and that river goes away. Somebody else gets your water. You know, you conserved, which is a good thing, but that conservation may have been to furnish water to somebody else downstream. You know, you may not benefit from that, but somebody does.
The Gila River has its headwaters in the southwestern corner of New Mexico, just west of the Continental Divide. The Gila stretches for hundreds of miles, all the way to Yuma, Arizona, where it empties into the Colorado River. The Gila River watershed has provided homeland for many Indian tribes, including Apaches and Ottawa peoples. Author Dutch Salmon lives near the headwaters of the Gila River and has long been concerned with the wildlife of this watershed.
Well, there's the otter reintroduction and the wolf reintroduction. Both have been approved. The otter introduction is less controversial. It's somewhat controversial up in Catron County, but beyond that, it's generally approved of. And it's just a question of getting some otters from another state and turning them loose in the Gila. I think we can accomplish that, and I think they'll do well once they get there. The wolf reintroduction is much trickier It's been going on now for 10 years. There's only about 55 wolves at loose in the wild in the two states, New Mexico and Arizona, right along the state line. We haven't made the progress projected by the Fish and Wildlife Service. There should have been at least 100 wolves by now, at least a dozen breeding pairs. And we've only got about half that many wolves and only three or four breeding pairs. Another problem, there have been wolves shot illegally by nobody knows who. There have been wolves taken out for depredating on cattle. This was to be expected to some extent, but the numbers aren't keeping up.
During the late 19th century, the Apache Indians made heroic attempts to defend their homeland from encroachment from intruders of European descent. They were the last to be subdued by the United States military. The Chiricahua Apaches were so feared that their survivors were never given their own reservation in the Gila River homeland. Joe Sienz is a Chiricahua Apache outfitter who has spent much of his life wandering through the Gila wilderness, leading expeditions, and educating his clients about natural balance within the Gila homeland. Here, he speaks of Apache lifeways that have been passed down through the generations.
The place that we see ourselves in is that we don't consider ourselves above nature. We consider ourselves as a part of it. And so whatever we did to the environment, we did to ourselves. The code of ethics for Apaches was peace and harmony. Peace among people and harmony with the environment. And that pretty much set a standard that we had to live by. Whatever we did, we had to do in mind that we were not the only ones that were going to use it, that there were going to be generations behind us using it, there was going to be families behind us using it, there was going to be somebody right behind us using it, you know, afterwards. And so the culture itself dictated our behavior in the environment. We had everything from, you know, what a lot of people consider as quaint mythology, mythological stories, stories of creation. But those stories were a distinctive outlay of our expected behavior. Everything from what animals you could eat and what animals you couldn't eat, when you could do certain functions or events, the structure of the family, all of that had stories that evolved and made a person understand the meaning of it. But if you take it a step further, you can see that they were also stories that were intended to provide a lesson of the environment. Taboo foods. We were supposed to only, in that period of time, you know, before a settlement and before the American culture expanded to this country, we were basically supposed to only eat four-legged, air-breathing herd animals. Not predators, nothing of that nature that controlled other herd animals. So that in itself was just a matter of culling the herd. Fish is a good example. Traditionally, Apaches did not eat fish. I lived in Alaska, and so I understood the value of fish up there and how much fish it takes to keep a people fed. And so I can see that in this country, traditionally, Gila trout was the only fish here. And so through some mechanism, through some teaching, fish became a taboo food for us. I can see why. You know, we would have decimated that population if we tried to eat that fish. There's just not enough fish here. And so that in itself preserved the water, preserved the ecology of those animals and that existence there. Number of family. Traditionally, Apaches usually only had one child every 4 years. And that made sense because of the resources, the movement, practicality, defense. Even though we have stories that acquaint to them as evolution and culture of Apaches, I guess because of my upbringing in schooling and formal education, trying to look more at a scientific application to it, I can easily see why those were very strong and practical and effective methods of teaching the people and passing that on to them.
Many Native American peoples still retain a balanced perspective when it comes to homeland. Although every Native American culture has been greatly influenced by Western monoculture, itself dominated by an economically driven paradigm. Through perseverance and cultural integrity, many Indian people still retain elements of cultural attitudes based on reverence for the flow of nature. Indeed, this is one of their great contributions to the human species. Fortunately, others are beginning to perceive that economics, as it is currently practiced, has contributed a destructive element into Western monoculture. Again, Brian Miller.
If we're going to learn to live within nature instead of on top of it, we have to change our attitude of domination and wanting to control and change. And we need to learn how we can live within the boundaries of nature instead of on top of it. At present, we just keep acting as if there is, as one author put it, an eternal frontier. We can just keep eating what's in front of us. And when we don't have enough energy in New York to heat houses, we go to the Beaufort Coast and we take energy there and bring it down. But we can only do that so long. As long as we keep eating whatever's in front of us, we eventually wind up in our own backyard. We can't just overexploit a resource and go on to something else.
The bottom line is that we as a culture must redefine our system of ethics to better align ourselves with the health of homeland. Author and activist William DeBuis has written extensively about environmental concerns. His book, Seeing Things Whole, The Essential John Wesley Powell, provides enormous insight into the mind of the man who well recognized that the arid West should be organized and governed from within watersheds. Indeed, Powell strongly forwarded the concept of watersheds as commons, a concept that 21st century Western Americans would be wise to explore and adopt. William DeBuis.
The idea of a more or less local board running the place is kind of interesting from this standpoint, not that it is a privatization of resources, of public resources, but that it's an experiment in the de-bureaucratization of land management. It's actually something much closer to what Powell had in mind, where watershed people come together to determine how they're going to take care of their commons, instead of having experts whose loyalty is directed to a power center far away calling the shots.
On this episode of Watersheds as Commons, we've heard from Stacy Galassini, Roberta Ball, Brian Miller, and Jim Wilcox, who were interviewed by Lore of the Land field researcher and writer Sonia Dickey. And Wanda Hughes, M. Hall, Dutch Salmon, Joe Sainz, and William DeBuis. Theme music was provided by Carl Bernstein. Production of this episode of Watersheds as Commons is funded by the Christensen Fund and the New Mexico Humanities Council and the New Mexico History Museum, and is produced in the studios of the Leffler Oral History Archive in Santa Fe, New Mexico. For free access to other Lore of the Land programming, please visit our website at www.loreoftheland.org. For the Lore of the Land, this is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening. Mm-hmm.